Welcome to the Pardes Parsha podcast. My name is Zvi Hirschfield, and I have the distinct privilege and pleasure of discussing the profound analysis and deep insights into the Parsha from my wonderful colleagues at the Pardes Institute. So glad you could join us. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another exciting and informative Pardes Parsha podcast. We are in the book of Leviticus, the book of Vayikra. We are in Parshat Tzav, and we are joined by, I believe, the leader. I have not checked the leaderboard, but back by popular, overwhelming demand, Nechama Goldman-Barash. Hello, Nechama.
Hi, Zvi. Great to be here, and I'm very happy that I'm the leading podcaster for this podcast. It's always fun, and we end up having very enriching conversations about the Parsha.
Wow, thank you. And you bring some good Torah with you each time, so we're very happy to have you. So here we are. We'll jump right into it. You know, the book of Vayikra, of course, is a challenge for many modern readers. It jumps right in with heavy details about different types of sacrifices and, you know, what's called korbanot in Hebrew, and the details of how they have to be offered and the structure and what is brought for what. And I venture a guess that some modern readers start flipping pages ahead, looking for a little narrative to find something they can relate to. And I'm just sort of wondering if you could speak about how you approach these parshiot and what you found in this parsha in particular that caught your attention.
Sure. I'll say that I was, until not long ago, one of those readers who flipped through to find the narrative. And really, I think we've done a podcast on this, the death of Nadav and Avihu, which appears in chapter 10. So really, the first story takes place 10 long chapters into the book, finding Vayikra challenging. The first half really is about a world that no longer exists, and a world that sadly became very corrupted. I teach a lot of Bayit Sheni, the Second Temple period, and really the priesthood becomes very corrupted by power, by money, and it's a world that ultimately is destroyed. And yet here we are every year, because it's a central part, really the middle part of the five books of Moses, we go back and we read it again and again. And the challenge is to find meaning in texts that are not applied in a practical way. And I think what caught my attention this year is this juxtaposition between the word sacrifice and the very detailed structure for presenting the world of sacrifice, along with the commandments to sacrifice. So if I take the word sacrifice, really to me, sacrifice is something you choose to do. There's something very voluntary about it. When I sacrifice something, there's a chosen element to it. And in addition, there should be a kind of free-form structure for how I choose to sacrifice. And yet this entire part of the book is so detailed and structured that it began to pique my interest. Like, what is the relationship between being commanded and sacrifice?
Especially, I guess, when you consider these opening sacrifices are brought out of the initiative of the bringer in the book of Vayikra, at least the opening chapters of Vayikra. And so I hear what you're suggesting is that there's a tension there. On the one hand, I'm doing something voluntary. I want to bring this gift to God, if that's how I understand what a korban might be. And yet there are all these rules governing how I do it, the way I do it, what I bring. And there's a certain tension between my own initiative and yet all the rules that come from outside of me in the system.
Right. And so you and I, in our last podcast on Kitisa, talked a lot about relationship between one another, relationship between us and God, ruptures in relationship. And I'm always looking in the texts that I study for something that can inform my own personal relationships with the people around me, with God. And, you know, that word sacrifice suggests, again, I get to choose what I sacrifice. But the reality is, in my relationship with my children, in my relationship with my partner, with my husband, my relationship with my parents, a lot of the sacrifice is based on what I would say tedious expectations or the things that need to get done. And so, you know, on one hand, we romanticize the idea of sacrifice, the nobility, the nobleness of sacrificing for an ideology, sacrificing for another. But in reality, every day, I would argue, there are small sacrifices we do when we choose to do something for the other that we don't really want to do or that we're expected to do.
You know, the relationship with the other, I might enter that in some way voluntarily, but once I'm in, there are rules and expectations and needs and details that govern how it all operates.
Absolutely. And so I'm always looking horizontally, and then I look vertically towards God to recognize that a lot of the elements that we bring into our relationship with one another are elements that become paramount in our relationship with God, that the need for structure, the need for detail, the need for constancy, and yet the commanded element, the fact that God commands. But I like what you said earlier, I choose to be in relationship with God. If I'm not in relationship with God, a fire is not going to come out and strike me down. But if I want to be in relationship with God, then there's an expectation of what that is going to look like.
Well, not everybody would agree. Some people would think, right, that fire comes and it's not really up to us. But I understand as a modern reader, you're more inclined to think that we have to at least come forward to engage. So let's talk about that image of fire.
Yes.
Because fire is very important to the running of this Mishkan. Sacrifices, most sacrifices that we see and do, maybe all of them, come in contact with fire at one point or another.
So the verse I'd really like to hone in on, focus on, is in the Parsha of Tzav, and it is, Esh tamid tukad al hamizbeach lo tichbeh. So this idea of the eternal fire will be laid on the altar, it will not go out. And so linking back to what we talked about, right, this idea of constancy. So it's suggested here that the fire will be eternal. The fire will not go out. But of course, we know that's really impossible. A fire by its nature is extinguished, right? When it runs out of fuel, when it runs out of whatever is fueling it, it has to be extinguished and then it has to be relit. So this idea of an eternal flame on the altar that will not go out or is not extinguished, to me, then bumps up against some of what I was talking about. Flame seemingly represents passion, seemingly represents this ongoing commitment, the ongoing sacrifice. And at the same time, it goes out and has to be relit. And there are many both verses and commentaries that address the need every day for the priest to come in and clear out the ashes and relight the fire. So I have a description of a flame that never goes out, right? The flame of Torah, the flame of mitzvot, the flame of sacrifice, the flame of relationship. But what I think is more powerful is the idea that in fact it does go out and has to be relit every day.
Well, it's funny because I guess that phrase, it will not be extinguished, I guess some could read that as some kind of supernatural promise. Right, there's going to be this miraculous thing that happens that this flame will just continue burning. I'm almost getting like a burning bush image, right? That the flame burns, the bush is not consumed. This idea of some kind of divine heavenly fire. But you said, if I understand you correctly, you took in the direction of this is in a way a type of commandment to the human servers in the temple. This flame that's there, it's up to you to maintain it and make sure that it never extinguishes.
It will be extinguished, and then you have to relight it so that it continues to burn, right? So it is fairly clear from the rest of the biblical passages and from rabbinic interpretation in the Talmud that a key element to the sacrificial practice was shoveling out the ashes and relighting the fire. So the Sefer HaChinuch, which is from the Middle Ages, talks very beautifully about that every day the priests have to come in and put on the wood, right, in the morning and in the afternoon, and that the fire from below essentially connects to the fire coming down from heaven, right? That there's this partnership, which I think we talked about in our last podcast as well. In the world of tabernacle, there needs to be a partnership where we actively elicit the response of the divine. And so I think the image or the metaphor of fire is a wonderful metaphor for that, that we actively have to light the fire in order to elicit a response from the divine, or perhaps if we go to today, a response of the divine within us, right? We actively seek out and light the fire.
So there's some kind of combination of human fire, if we like that term, human initiative, human creativity, human action, that what you're suggesting in that text you quote is somehow met or responded to with some supernatural connection at the same time, that the tabernacle is this meeting point between human fire and divine fire all at the same time.
Yeah, I think that speaks to me. And of course, we no longer have the tabernacle. We no longer have the temple. So then it means in my own private life, whether it's the world of Torah, the world of prayer, the world of seeking, relationship with divine, I have to actively elicit it. And I'll segue to something I hear a lot from my 18-year-old students. We're just not feeling it. We don't feel inspired, right? Like, here we are, we're doing all these mitzvot and we're praying and we're learning Torah and we're not feeling it, right? Like, there's something in the tedium of having to get up every day to do the same mitzvot over and over. And Nechama, we're bored, we're not feeling it. There's no fire, there's no passion. And so I want to quote something here that Rabbi Yehuda Brandis wrote. Service requires consistency and constancy. It does not contain the same excitement. There is an element of routine to it, which can sometimes be exhausting and dispiriting. For one-time events, one can rely on passion and spontaneity. For enduring commitments, on the other hand, one needs steadiness and steadfastness. And so I think the juxtaposition of fire and tamid really illuminates this tension, the balance between excitement and devotion, which is where we started, right? The sacrifice. There's something very romantic, very idealized about sacrifice. But then I start thinking, well, the sacrifice is taking out the garbage and doing the dishes, right? That sense of routineness in relationship with spouses, with children, with parents, and with God. And yet I still need to get up and light the fire.
Well, this idea of a korban tamid, right? This idea that it's going to happen every day. For what your students would say, it's already building the problem right in there. Anything that happens every day doesn't feel special and exciting. Most people are not excited by the fact they turn on their tap and warm water comes out to take a shower. If anything, they're furious if warm water doesn't come out, but they don't sit there and go, wow, can you believe I'm about to put this soothing, comforting warm water on my skin? I'm going to feel great. Now, if we could only shower once a month, I'm not recommending that for any of our listeners, we'd be pretty excited when that hot water came out of that faucet. So I'm wondering here, did the Torah set up a certain challenge already by saying all this passion that you're going to have in the sacrificial system? Well, you're going to do the same thing over and over again. So it might be the first 6 weeks are really exciting, but after that, it's going to look routine to you. Even that fire is just going to look like regular old fire to you. And then the challenge is going to begin. How are you going to still see it
as fire?
As fire, or experience it as fire. And I'm also wondering if there's this problem of the feedback loop that we do these things, we pray, but we kind of want answers. It's hard to always be the talker and feel like you're not being responded to. And I think I'm just wondering if that too, that sense of, well, I'm going to keep this thing going, but where's the heavenly response? Where's the energy I'm supposed to get back to keep me going?
I think that's a really great, you know, kind of parallel, the move from the world of temple to the world of prayer. Of course, it's very much inherent in the Tractate of Brachot, where there's a clear shift from sacrifice that we do twice a day that only the priests do to a much more democratic framework of interacting with God, which is really three times a day and everyone can pray. And so prayer, as we know from that tractate, and I know both of you have taught that tractate, substitutes for actual sacrifice. So now what I'm calling avoda or sacrifice is related to the constancy of getting up or going into the synagogue or a corner in my workspace in order to pray to God. The same words, right? Because as the generations go on from the Mishnah onward, we create a uniform text. So really every day you're saying the same thing and there's a constancy to it that can lead to the same shchika, the same erosion of inspiration, the same erosion of a sense of excitement in directly addressing God or beseeching God or showing gratitude towards God. And I think we see that over and over in the way rabbis, people who pray, commentaries, interpreters interact with these questions of routine and kavanah, routine and intent.
Well, it's just funny because what you just described in a way that the sages had this opportunity. There's no more temple. They could turn towards a system that's completely spontaneous. Maybe Rabbi Eliezer even did when he spoke about all prayer having to be tachanunim, right? Having to be supplication or it's not real. But they have this opportunity to move away from this fixed, organized system. And I'm wondering, like, why then do you think did they buy right back in? What was the value that they saw in the tamid, in the constancy and consistency? Why was that so important to them, do you think, that they were willing to accept the risk or the inevitable challenge that's going to come with repetition and with routine?
So I'm going to go to Avram Yehoshua Heschel, because how can I not in these moments? And I'm going to just read one sentence, and maybe if I have time, another passage. The pull of regularity usually proves to be stronger than the pull of spontaneity. And as a result, there is a perpetual danger of prayer becoming a mere habit, right? An exercise in repetitiveness. However, right, without that pull of regularity, it's very likely I won't pray, or I'll pray very, very infrequently. In other words, what pulls me into opening my prayer book three times a day is the idea that I know that I have to, right? That there's a framework, there's a structure, there's an expectation. But that does get in the way of the sense of what Rabbi Eliezer in the Mishnah says is tachanunim, or a real sense of beseeching God, right? To quote the full citation in the Mishnah. Rabbi Eliezer says, anyone who makes his prayer fixed, his prayer is not genuine. His prayer doesn't really have the aspect of beseeching God. On the other hand, if I'm brutally honest with myself, without a fixed prayer service, without an expectation and a time frame for prayer, I would pray a lot less. In other words, I would pray when the mood took me, when I was feeling very sad, when I'm feeling very happy, when I'm feeling very grateful or very scared. But on a day-to-day basis, often, thank God, my life is regular. My life goes through the regular routine of someone who gets up and goes to work and comes home and calls her kids and so on and so forth, right? Even look what I'm describing. The regularity of my life, the schedule of my life is somewhat fixed. It's not spontaneous, which is why I can make a living, which is why I can give to my children what they need and to my partner. And in some ways, shouldn't my relationship with God have similar manifestations of regularity? So I'm always able to access it. And I think prayer becomes this fixed point. And then the question is, how do I sometimes light the fire so it's more inspiring, more of a conversation with God rather than just something I do?
I have two reactions. The first to what you said is there's something very countercultural, because what you're saying is basically you don't wait for the feeling and then act. You don't wait to feel that surge of passionate love for your children and then you get into your car and drive them to the 40 places they need to go, or pay for that extra thing that you really didn't want to pay for, or the host of other things that we do as parents for our kids. But in fact, it's probably the reverse. You probably do all these behaviors, and then when you reflect at the end of your day, you probably say something like, wow, I really must love that kid, because I just went through one heck of a day with that kid, or my spouse, or whoever it is, right? But this idea that feelings can come later and not come first, obligation can come first, it's very countercultural. It's very not romantic. It could feel very dry. But you're saying that that's sort of built in to this recipe that the Torah is offering us for our relationships, both with God and with one another.
Give me another minute to quote another passage from Heschel, and then something from Maimonides, and then I'm curious to see what your thoughts are. Heschel writes, "How grateful I am to God that there is a duty to worship, a law to remind my distraught mind that it is time to think of God, time to disregard my ego for at least a moment. It is such happiness to belong to an order of the divine will. I am not always in a mood to pray. I do not always have the vision and the strength to say a word in the presence of God. But when I am weak, it is the law that gives me strength. When my vision is dim, it is duty that gives me insight." And first of all, I so respond to that, right? That idea that I feel held, even when I'm annoyed, frustrated, like I don't have time or I don't want to go pray right now. But, and of course I can choose not to, but when I choose to, the idea that the law gives me strength, the expectation, the framework that I'm walking into something that's already fixed allows me on some days to walk into it.
So it's very powerful what you're saying, but then it still begs that follow-up question. And I'll go back to the metaphor of fire that you've been using, I think, very effectively. So what happens when I am going to do my duty, do my job? I'm going to go through all the motions, but the fire never gets lit. You know, in other words, I'm going to take your example, but change it a little bit. I wake up in the morning and I don't feel like praying, which I'd be embarrassed to tell you how often that happens to me. I don't think I could think of a time where I have gone to morning minyan with a desire to go. I'm embarrassed to admit the desire is to have gone, which is not the same as the desire to go. But at the same time, I still want to ask you this question. What do you do then when you do your job and you fulfill the law, the obligation, but the fire didn't happen? You came out of that experience with the same dullness or lack of connection that you went into it with.
So I probably have to put on my hat a little bit of, you know, sometimes I do pastoral counseling for couples. I certainly do some counseling for my students. You know, it's interesting because if someone came to me and said, you know, I've been married for 25 years, I go through the routine, I go through the motions, I do everything I'm supposed to, everything I'm expected to, I play the role, but I don't feel anything. The fire isn't there. So because I'm not a marriage therapist, right, as I said, I do pastoral counseling, first of all, that would sadden me deeply. And, you know, I would begin the process of trying to explore where a different entry point into the relationship could come from. Is there a direction that might elicit a different kind of response in the relationship? But I hear it, meaning sometimes relationships just end. They peter out. They come to a stop. The romantic in me wants to believe that it's always possible to relight the fire if there's goodwill and intention and hard work. I do want to believe that. And I think, you know, if I had colleagues of mine who are therapists, I think they would be likely to agree with me that if there's an interest in really saving the relationship, many times it can be saved, not always. And our last podcast was about utter betrayal and the fact that you can rebuild from that and sometimes something even stronger. If I now shift to relationship with God, right, which what would that even mean to be divorced from God or to end the relationship with God? People do. People walk away from all sorts of relationships. It's hard to actually give an answer when someone says to me, well, where do I find inspiration from, without saying to them, okay, try this ritual, try this practice, try to say blessings, try to learn this text, try to find a religious person that you feel inspired by. In other words, it's the romantic in me who says, seek out, light the fire, right? Do something active. And at the end of the day, I know that sometimes, despite everyone's best wishes, it doesn't happen. And I know that even in relationship with God, there are people who will say we've been seeking our whole lives and we've never had a really transcendent moment. We've never had that. And that saddens me. And it also, I recognize that's part of being human and part of sometimes not getting to where we think we're going to get or, you know, having that kind of response. I will say, Rambam says something interesting. Again, I would learn this with someone, that he says every blessing we say, right, this idea of the constancy of blessings on things that we're both grateful for, things that we praise God for, and sometimes just because, is to remind us of God's presence in all sorts of different ways and all sorts. So it's not prayer. It's not the fixed long liturgy, but these short bursts of moments of thanks, of beseeching, of gratitude, of awareness, right? Whether it's the food I eat or the lightning or the thunder, maybe those are more effective in these short bursts of recognition of God's presence than sometimes the longer liturgy.
Well, you know, what you're suggesting here, I'm going back to our Kohen in the Mikdash, that when he lights that fire in the morning, he just has to have the emunah that the human fire is going to be met by the divine fire, using that language. And I say emunah because often he may not have a concrete experience of it being there, but he has to somehow trust that it's there. And I feel that maybe that's what you're suggesting throughout. We go into these practices, we go into these rituals, we go into these structures, and we have to bring emunah to them, in the sense that I don't have a guaranteed outcome, logically, scientifically, but I believe that the outcome is possible. And if it's not going to happen today, it'll happen tomorrow, but that fundamentally it can happen. And I would say that that emunah is so fundamental to everything that you're talking about. And sometimes it gets confirmed, in rare moments it gets confirmed, but a lot of times it's tested. That's the test of constancy. Constancy is not a test if we're in a feedback loop where we always get what we came to get, right? In other words, it's not a test of constancy if every time I press the lever and a pellet comes out and I get to eat it, right?
Right.
The test of constancy is if I press that button 200 times, and then the pellet comes out, and then that's enough to make me believe that pressing on that lever
is
worthwhile, and that would keep me going. So I'd say that there's no escaping the need for emunah, regardless.
Emunah and, you know, the desire to grow in some way, right? Like the emunah is my faith that, like you said, eventually I'm going to get there. It may take longer than I thought, but eventually I'm going to have that sense of connection, that sense of divine presence. And I want to share a poem from Yehuda Amichai, which I found through Aviva Richman at Hadar, so I want to give her the credit as well. What really Amichai emphasizes is that there's a power in memory. So it's possible what will fuel me, what will fuel my emunah, is remembering a moment of transcendence that might have taken place when I was a child, when I was a young adult, right? Years ago, but that memory of what that experience could be can sometimes be what fuels me into continuing getting up every day and either going through the motions or trying to make more of it. And the same thing with love, of course. Sometimes our memories of what was maybe the heat, the passion, the spontaneity is what allows me to continue perpetuating the relationship. And I'm going to read Amichai now. My God, the soul you have given me is smoke from the constant burning of memories of love. We are born and immediately start to burn until the smoke, like smoke, dissipates. What I find beautiful about Amichai is that, you know, the fire is not fire, it's smoke, right? The memory is of the fire that is now retained in the smoke. And this idea that our souls might not be fueled by the present interaction, but possibly by, like you said, even about davening, when I'm finished, that sense of, oh, I did that, and that left some sort of impact. Sometimes it's not in the moment of interaction, but it's in the memory of the interaction, the memory of the sacrifice, which is portrayed here by the smoke.
That's a kinder interpretation of my tefillah experience, and I would have offered it, so I'm going to take it. Uh-huh. And there's also, of course, this idea of fire and smoke. It brings us back to the temple imagery and the sacrifices and what's going on there. So, of course, I must bring us to our contemporary lives in a couple ways. First, I want to ask you, in your own life, what do you do when you find the routine is overwhelming you? What are the tools that you use to try to reconnect, re-excite, find a new energy?
So, you know, there are times I will sometimes stop something. In other words, when we talk about prayer, and again, whether I should be admitting this on a podcast, I don't know, but it's just you and me here, it's me, so who knows who's
maybe
listening.
Like 1,000 other people.
Maybe, right. There have been times I've stopped praying, right? Because it became too routine, because I felt nothing when I was doing it. And sometimes taking that break allowed me to both miss the framework of prayer and to be able to re-enter it with renewed energy. So I am a believer in that. I once had a student where I also told her, she was struggling, I think it was with brachot, with blessings. And I said, why don't you take a break and see if that does anything? And she then shared with me that when she came back, it was a much more positive experience. So, you know, the separation, right? Sometimes couples separate in order to be able to rekindle their relationship. And so I'm not getting into what the halachic ramifications are for that. I'm not giving a rabbinic stamp of approval to anyone. I'm just saying sometimes a break can allow a re-entry. Obviously, the danger is sometimes a break becomes a permanent break. But I find that sometimes that's been effective. Sometimes I really will try to go to a completely different kind of text. I've been much more drawn to Chassidut. I never thought I would learn Chassidut, but in the last number of years, I find there's something there that at times is more profound than the Talmud that I learned deeply. And I love Talmud. I love rabbinic texts. That's where I really find myself and my soul. And sometimes it's not enough and I need to find a different text. Sometimes I need to read something that's not by a Jewish author. I need to find inspiration outside of where I would normally go for inspiration, to find a thinker or a poem or something that inspires me. So I would say, as you can hear, I'm constantly trying to do, right? Sometimes it's going for a long walk day after day, breathing in the air and feeling a sense of gratitude. Meditation sometimes helps for me, right? There are different things I try to do to restart my soul.
You know, I think the two things that came to me that I try and probably not often enough, and they're mixed results. One is I try to act as if, right? In other words, I say, what would the Tzvi Hirschfeld that is filled with emunah right now, how would he be in the world? And I try to take on that persona for a while to see if something clicks or fits. I have found very hard to sustain, but it's still a worthwhile exercise. And the one that can cut both ways is engaging people who are feeling it. right? Yeah. And sometimes I come away feeling like, oh, I got a new idea. It strengthened my emunah that it's possible. And sometimes I come away feeling more alienated, especially when you ask that person, don't you find it hard to say this or that? And they look at you and they're like, what could be hard? It's the most beautiful, exciting, wonderful thing. Prayers are the highlight of my day. And then I feel like, uh-oh. Wow, I'm not there at all. So I find that that role model person,
yes,
it can really cut both ways. Yes. And so it can be risky when you try to attach
it
to that person.
It can bring you down
in
or lift you up. And you just have to know a little bit of yourself to know what direction it's going to take you in.
So my follow-up question for you, of course, as we always get back here on this podcast these days, the issue of sacrifice, right? And we cover it as a sense of bringing gifts to God, korban, like being close to God. But we can't ignore the fact that sacrifice also includes giving something up for God, something of value, something that you care about, whether it's wine or an animal, or it's something of visible, tangible meaning to you that you are giving up as part of your relationship with God or as part of what God is commanding. And I'm wondering what you do with that image in this book right now as we are where we are in the state of Israel today, and sort of what associations that brought you.
Yeah, so, you know, we're heading down into a more darker space than perhaps we've been in. The word korban, sacrifice, certainly is bringing up the large numbers of young men who continuously have been called upon to sacrifice, literally give up their lives, but also leave their lives, right? The sense of leaving all that is near and dear, their families, their children, their professions, their schooling, in order to go out and fight in this war. And so the word korban is hanging very heavy for me. And in fact, when I was reading Yehuda Amichai, really, if I just stop with that first line, my God, the soul you have given me is smoke, to me, that's evoking all of the dead. Right, so many have died in this war, and that sense of so much smoke, right? So much, so many have just kind of disappeared. And
there's a Holocaust image there for me whenever you talk about going up in smoke.
Yes, yes. And so I'm feeling the sense of memory, the memory of those we love who are no longer. And I think this year, reading this book is going to be a very different experience.
It does push me to these very difficult questions of, God, is this what you want from us, right? Is this what you're calling upon us to do? These are the korbanot that we of the Jewish people have to bring to do what we need to do. And it's a scary, terrifying, horrifying thought. On the other hand, there's not a generation of Jews that would have been unable to ask that question. God, do you really want us to stick with this plan in terms of the way the world treats us, in terms of our place in the world and what we're exposed to? You know, is this still the plan? And it does make me both feel incredibly proud of all of those Jews everywhere that are choosing to affirm and connect to their Jewishness in spite of the crazy emerging risks to our well-being that are coming out. But it also just makes me wonder, like, really? This is what you want? This is what we have to bring? This is what we have to sacrifice? So I realize I left you in a terrible spot to respond to that, but that's sort of where I am.
Yeah. You know, I think I'll go to, you know, Jonathan Sacks often
has a word.
Yeah. And what he says is the word sacrifice means bringing or coming close. To come close to God means there's a sense of renouncing, right? Our power, our will, our autonomous being, our self-sufficiency. We must give something up. And I think both of us went to a place of what we're being called on to give up right now is not what we want to give up, right? That sense of you're asking too much of us, God, or where is this going? But really, he then segues to this idea of prayer. And this idea of prayer is where we offer back to God the gift of our being. And I think there's been a lot of prayer. I think there's been a lot of individual prayer and a lot of communal prayer and in all sorts of different communities. I think there are those outside of the Jewish people who are praying for us and those within who perhaps have never prayed who are praying. This sense of suddenly being aware of how vulnerable we are, how fragile we are after many decades of feeling very self-sufficient and very strong. And so I'm hoping that the sacrificial aspect that we've been talking about will begin to dwindle, right? That we won't be called upon for very much longer to be thinking about sacrifice in the sense of great sacrifice. And I'm hoping we'll be able to see that really this period will cycle us back to an awareness of the divine presence in the positive sense of where we are right now and where this is taking us.
I want to see some good heavenly fire to match our fire. How's that?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I want to close with a story for you that I found very moving. Last night, I attended a wedding of a young man who I met. I was on a Beit Din through Giurka Halacha. We're not going to go down that road describing non-Rabbanut conversions in
We've
Israel.
We've actually done that before in a previous podcast.
Did we? We covered that? Nachum remembers everything. I don't remember anything. I don't know how she does it. In any event, so this young man, he got special permission. It was after October 7th. It was before the ground war started. I knew where he was serving because he was serving sort of adjacent to my son-in-law. And I know he was in some kind of elite unit. And he knew he was about to enter terrible risk. His commander gave him half a day off to go convert. And when he came in front of us to speak to us, and he described he had been learning for a long time. He was in the Rabbanut system for a while. He was engaged to a lovely young woman, and he was very committed. You wouldn't describe him as fully observant, but he had a lot of passion. And he literally said, I don't know what's going to happen to me in the next month or two. And if I die, I want to be sure I die as a Jew.
Wow.
So, of course, the tears are flowing on the parts of my peers on this Beit Din. And so I told him afterwards, I said, you got to invite me to your wedding. Whatever happens, I need to be at your wedding. And sure enough, my friend was, you know, Masader Kedushin, did the chuppah, and I got to be a witness. And I went purely for the most selfish reasons. Like, here was this person who he had no doubt this was worth risking everything for, being part of the Jewish people, building a Jewish family here in the land of Israel. He had no question in his heart that this was worth risking everything for. And I feel like in that moment, I fed off of that. Like, I kept thinking to myself, what a privilege to be around this person and to feel that energy. And at that chuppah, I'll just close with this. There was a short prayer, a Mishaberach prayer said for the soldiers and for the hostages. And people were just, and this was not a religious crowd, and people were so moved. And it just, for me, it affirms something very powerful that I keep waiting for the heavenly fire in response to our sacrifices, but the awareness of the Jewish people being so willing to sacrifice is just an amazing experience, and it props me up all the time.
And I'll just add, as you were talking about this young man, I thought, wow, you know, we're talking about Parshat Tzav, and of course, the Parsha of being commanded, right? There's a commandment of how to sacrifice and where and when. And here's a young man who was not commanded on the face of it, and yet very much felt the need to come and light the fire on the altar.
He felt completely commanded.
Yeah.
I don't know by whom, but he felt commanded.
And he came and lit that fire.
Absolutely.
Wow, Tzvi, I love it. Thank you. Thank you for that story.
Well, so we're going to end here. We're going to wish Ronen and Shelley just mazal tov and a life of happiness and health and well-being, and hopefully no more fighting and no more wars. And Nachama, thank you very, very much. It's been enlightening and challenging as always. And we want, of course, as we say, unfortunately, every time, Nachama, this is a terrible pattern for us, that this is recorded a few weeks before you're hearing it. So God willing, by the time you hear our voices on Parshat Tzav, the hostages will be returned and there will be peace and well-being and the heavenly fires will be lit. But where we stand now, we are still praying and hoping for that. And so we're offering our prayers in hopes that we will see that very, very soon. And God willing, we should merit to both light the fire and feel the response of that fire as often as we can. Thank you, Nachama, very, very much.
Thank you, Tzvi. Amen to all of the brachot you just gave.
Shabbat shalom, everyone, and hopefully please listen next week. Thank you for tuning in to the Pardes Parsha podcast, recorded here at Nomi Studios in Jerusalem. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode and gained some new insights and perspectives on the Torah portion. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite streaming platform and leave us a 5-star review if you enjoyed the episode. Your feedback helps us reach more people with these important conversations. Thanks again for listening, and we look forward to exploring the Torah with you again next week on the Pardes Parsha podcast. Shabbat Shalom.